The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everybody. Nice to see you all. Right now here at the Village Zendo, we're kind of coming towards the end of our winter ongo, our winter intensified practice period, which is about 3 months, and it's going to end. The culmination will be on, I think it's March 8th. We'll have this big ceremony here. And it's a nice time. It was originally came from in India when they would have these really rainy seasons where it would like rain for 3 months in a row. And so, Buddha and his disciples thought, hey, this is a great time, a great time to just meditate a lot. So we've continued in many different practices, have continued this practice of these three-month angos, and now we're doing it here as well. And we have a practice leader, and it started off with a retreat at the Garrison Institute, and it also includes longer zazenkais. Zazenkais here, the daily sits are usually about 7-8 hours, and now they're about 12 for this period of time. So it's a really kind of cool period of time where everybody is kind of making a commitment to deepen their practice and to, dive into whatever it is that we do here a little bit more. And something that goes along with that is we're always given a study text for the time period. And so the study text we have this time, which is for sale up there, is a book called Zen Echoes. And it's a book of kind of classic Zen koans, Zen riddles, with commentaries by three female Zen masters. I'm going to focus on one of these koans today, and also really focus on one of these masters, Chan Master Baoqi, who, for no other reason than that I really loved her responses to the koans, and they kind of reverberated with me. So I'm going to read the koan, and then kind of go through let me read the koan first. So the koan says, in Dahui's hall, the master held up a bamboo whisk and asked his students, if you call it a bamboo whisk, that's an affront to its conditioned existence. If you don't call it a whisk, you are denying its material reality. You cannot not use words. So I chose this one, which happens to be the last one in the book, because I feel like this conundrum that this koan poses is one that we see very often in Zen. We're told it's either A or B. A is wrong, and B is also wrong. So what is it? Right? And so there's something about these kind of conundrums that when I first heard them, there was something kind of very enticing about them. There was something very seducing about them, in a sense. They kind of lured me in. I've always been someone who's really been into games and puzzles and stuff like that, So when I first heard about, I first started hearing these things, it's like, well, wait a second. It's either A or B, but it's neither. or both, or what? Or what? It's like, I don't get it. So there was something that really kind of drew me in, the gaming part of me, the part of me that's into riddles and trying to solve things. And then there's another aspect to this, which I think struck a little bit deeper. And the other aspect to this, for me, was it's saying that there is a secret. There's some kind of secret. And you don't know it, because if you did know it, you'd know the answer to that question. So there was something about, okay, not only is this a riddle, but there's some kind of a secret, or something that I can, some kind of secret thing that I can get from this. It reminded me of this story that I tell frequently about John Lennon. When John Lennon and the Beatles were in India hanging out with the Maharishi, there was one day on his commune there. There was one day when the Maharishi was going to go into town, and going into town there meant a helicopter ride. So the Maharishi came and made the announcement that he was going to the town, and there was one extra seat on the helicopter. Would anyone else like to join him? And John immediately raised his hand and said, oh, me. And he ran to the front, and he took the trip with the Maharishi into town. And then when they came back, it was Paul that told this story in one of these documentaries. When they came back, he went up to John and he asked him, he said, what was that about? You know, what'd you run to the front of the line for that for? And John said, I was hoping he might slip me the answer. So I feel like there is this part of us that wants to, you know, we want to get into the secret. We want to know this, what these, I don't know, the things that we don't know. Realize that there's something that we don't know, and we think that there's these, that these spiritual practices that will give us this information. So then the question arises, why are we looking for this secret? Why are we enticed by this secret? Why are we looking for something that we don't know the answer to? And I think the answer in that usually has to do with why we come into practice in the first place. And in my experience with myself and with others that I've seen in the Zendo, there's usually some kind of pressing issue in one's life that usually first brings us in. The death of a parent, an illness, whatever it be. It could even be just a big life change, maybe like getting fired from a job or getting a new job or getting married or having a child. And any of these things maybe can bring up these existential issues, problems in our life. Problems that maybe present a similar type of quandary as this koan does. Right, a lot of times, for me it was something similar to that. It was like I was facing something in my life that I couldn't find the answer for. I didn't know. All these things were presenting themselves just like A and B, it's either this or that. But none of them seemed to work. So then we make this commitment to come into practice. At least for me, that's what I did, and many people do. After we take these first few steps, and it seems like a place that is safe and comfortable to reveal these issues in our life, and It's a time of great vulnerability, usually, and also I think it's a time of great courage. It takes a lot of courage to enter a practice like this, because you're kind of saying, admitting that there's things that you don't know, or maybe that you don't even know yourself. You don't even know who you are, what your life is. And you're willing to kind of let that spill out. So we come into practice and we first come and maybe we first start counting our breaths. And what I've noticed as a musician and music teacher as well is that whenever there's a new skill that we start to practice and that we start to learn, there's usually really big leaps of improvement in the beginning. So I'm reminded of a story Pema Chodron, famous Tibetan nun, spoke about this, about a time when she was in India, and she said that there was a lot of stray like dogs on the street in India, and she said that when she would be in her room sleeping at night, these dogs would be barking and making noises all night, barking and barking, and then every now and then, for no apparent reason, the barking would stop for maybe a minute, a couple minutes, and then it would start up again, and then the same thing a little while later, it would stop for maybe a few minutes. And she used that as a way to describe what our minds are like at the beginning of practice. All of a sudden we notice that there's all this blah, 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 blah chatter going on in our brains. And as we sit with it, at first there may be, in the course of a 30-minute period, maybe you're going to have 15 seconds of those dogs quiet. But in the beginning of our practice, I feel like if we really jump in wholeheartedly, we'll notice those intervals of silence and quiet growing. So what started off with 15 seconds maybe can turn into, you know, a couple minutes pretty quickly. And what starts to happen then, in those moments of quiet, is we're given a glimpse, maybe almost for the first time, of our own mind and how we operate internally. As a Zen Master Dogen Zenji said, he said, when we practice, we're taking a step back and turning the light around and shining it inward, shining the light inward to see what's there. And this is something that practice provides us, and it's something that we usually don't do without practice because we don't want to see what that light's going to shine on it. A lot of times. And so when those things that are the most guarded, the things that we guard the most, maybe the things that we consider to be problematic or dirty or wrong or shameful, whatever, it's usually a lot of them, some shape or form, all of a sudden they start to reveal themselves. And when that happens, we're past this beginning stage. And so just as I've seen in music, like once you make these first leaps to get onto this next level, then things start to become much more subtle and much more incremental. And so seeing our lives more clearly this way, we can begin to remember ourselves. I can't take credit for that. One of the Village Zendo senseis, who's not really around anymore, Onraku Sensei, gave this talk about 10, 15 years ago where she kept saying, remember, remember. So we're taking the parts of ourselves and remembering them. So seeing that, for me, seeing that I had been hiding from myself, that I had a lot of regret in my life, for example. Seeing that regret, I'm able to remember it, and reapply it to my being. And then, not sure timeline if this is the next thing that happens, but around the same time, I think we start to realize that we have this internal voice in our head that never stops. It's kind of like a narrator that's narrating our lives as we live it. I find the narrator would often also sum up for me events that had just happened. You know, like, oh wow, you really screwed that up. Or you know, what, you're definitely not good enough for that. Things, you know, these little voices that we start, or on the flip side of the same coin, you're a lot better than that one, than that person. or, wow, you're doing really, really, really great. All these things, these little narration voices. Also trying to predict the future. I feel like, okay, when you get there, this is what you're going to do. So you start to notice this like chatter that's going on in your mind, you know? And what I feel like we start to notice is that these voices and these kind of internal mechanisms that we've created are separating us from our experience. They're separating us from what's actually happening right now. And so we get lulled into these semi-conscious states with words like bamboo whisk. You know, in this book that I love called Drawing from the Right Side of the Brain, the author talks about the development of an artist or a child, the way that they draw. And there's a certain point in one's life when one realizes that what they're drawing on the page is a symbol for something that is actually out there in the world. And when we do that, when we put that label on it, then instead of seeing the actual lines of that chair, I just say to myself, chair. I know what a chair is. It's got a leg, it's got blah, 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 blah. And so I don't even look at it. And same thing going on here with this koan. If you call it a bamboo whisk, it's wrong. And if you don't call it a bamboo whisk, you're also wrong. So this is where koans come in. And koans are these conundrums, these riddles that are intended to confuse us, intended to stop our cognition. And there's many aspects of Zen and Zen practice that that reflect this. In a personal experience I had, it was when Ryotan Sensei, he's one of the teachers here, when he became a Hoshi, it was the second time that Roshi had turned someone into a Hoshi. It was the first time it happened on a retreat. And so we had this big celebration, and there was a service attached to it. And part of the service was that Ryo sat up there and engaged the whole community without people signing up in Dharma combat. So anybody, if they were moved, could ask a question. And so, you know, I was scared shitless. It was my first retreat, But I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to ask a question. So I raised my hand. And I had heard him in some of his talks talk about a moment when you kind of have this aha moment, or this or kind of a bodily felt realization. He would call it that the penny would drop. He would say the penny, but then the penny drops, or the penny dropped and something opened up. And so my question was, I've heard you speaking about this penny drop. What is the penny dropping? And he looked at me and he said, it just dropped. And it was like, it was literally like someone came and threw a bag over my head. And I was just like in the dark. I didn't know what to say. I was like completely confused and lost. And so I just said, thank you for your answer. But I thought about this for quite a while after that. It weighed on my mind. It's like what actually happened in that moment, right? It was like, I can express it as like something was being pulled over my head. But something happened that completely cut me off. And I wasn't able to engage anymore. And, after some years of practice, I feel like I had a tendency to dissociate, especially when something was uncomfortable, especially when something was comfortable in relation to others. So without getting into my personal history, what happens is that our practice gives us the tools, and we start to develop the skill to see what's there in those moments. So instead of just being like a bag was over my head, later on maybe you could step back and say, wait, what's going on here in that exact moment? And that's what practice affords us. And being pushed to our cognitive limit is also what practice is affording us, because when we're pushed to that limit, and why I think that I cut off, is because you become very, very exposed. When your mind doesn't have the answer to save you and to help you and to pull you out of this anymore, then it's your whole self, it's your whole being that has to deal with it. And at least in my sake, and I think in many people's sake, my mind constructed something to help avoid that situation from ever happening. I didn't ever want to have to be that exposed and that vulnerable. And it's because we're hiding something, or something is being tucked away in the nooks and crannies inside. And when we turn that light around and start to shine it inside, we can start to look and see in those nooks and crannies a little bit better. So practice gives us, it's a skill. And as we develop this skill over time, we're able to get closer and closer to that moment, right? So that moment happened for me, and to be honest, it took me years to really understand what happened. But sometimes maybe something happens for you, something triggers you, right? Something really gets you really upset and pulls you or sucks you out of yourself. For me, I think about anger and rage. Like if you've ever been really enraged and you feel like you don't know what just happened, right? You've been pulled out of yourself. So what practice gives us is the opportunity to maybe catch that before we get sucked out, before we get pulled out of ourselves, and see what's really there. Why am I getting this angry? Why am I about to like blow my lid and harm myself and probably others as well? So it gives us a chance to really catch that moment then maybe take a step back before it takes us, sweeps us away, and see who we really are. And you know, they also, there was also this, you also hear sometimes that there is no right or wrong answer for a koan, right? What does that mean? So I could say, from the aspect of music and being a musician, that just because you play the right notes doesn't mean that you play it right. If that can make sense. Right? I know a lot of, I've known a lot of musicians who are very, had a very strong technique on their instrument, and they could play all the right notes, but there's something missing. And then I knew, also know, on the opposite side, some musicians who didn't have a lot of their technique together, but that thing was there. So, you know, we have to have a teacher that tells us whether it's right or wrong. Is basically the reality of it, because this is very subtle stuff. And so, just because, you know, I've even heard that in Japan they have a book, or somebody published a book with all the answers to the koans. You know, so all the answers are there. But you know, if it's a good teacher, it doesn't matter if you say the right thing, right? And what I've also, in my experience, what I've noticed with koans is that you can sometimes have this aha moment, this, you know, this moment of, ah, I got it, and it's a bodily felt moment, right? I had this one, for example, there was this koan. I'll just give you my direct experience. The koan is very short. It says a master asked these two monks to raise these shades. And they both went and they both did it. They both raised the shades exactly the same. And the master said, that one has it right, that one is wrong. And, you know, sometimes the koan, it comes to you not when you're sitting, not when you're in the zendo, when you're in the world. And there was this one time I was out and I was watching a friend of mine play the piano. I'm a piano player too. And I started to notice how much I was judging myself against this guy. I was like, wow, I'm better than him at this. Oh, but he's better than me. You know, it's like all these things came up, and then it hit me. Wow, there's room in this world for both of us. And so I came upon the answer to that koan, not because I had these great puzzle and riddle solving skills, right? But because the koan made me have a direct experience. Right, and because I had that direct experience, that's what made me, you know, it's you don't actually, it's not like you graduate koans, it's not like one is more difficult than the next, but I was able to move on from and to the next one because of that. So I just want to end with the commentary that Chan Master Baoqi had for this koan. And I'm going to relate that to a more modern quote. So, Chan Master Baoqi says, Yunmen's bamboo whisk tips over a pile of poisonous herbs. Whether turning against or touching it, in neither case will it make great fire. It completely blocks up the throat and turns over the body. Why do you need to play with this idler's toy? Yunmen's bamboo whisk tips over a pile of poisonous herbs. Whether turning against or touching it, in neither case will it make great fire. It completely blocks up the throat. How can one breathe out? Once you've seen through it all, you can return. It's all just a bunch of crap. And this reminded me very much of a more pithy statement by the great saxophonist Charlie Parker. And he said, master your instrument, master the music, and then forget all that bullshit and just play.